Judge Pirtle and Judge Bishop from the Court of Appeals will be joining us. So let's give everybody a moment to get in and out of the courtroom. Ms. Hayden, good morning to you. We still have some folks coming in and out, so.
Good morning.
That looks to have occurred. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Annie Hayden. I am an assistant public defender in Douglas County, and I, along with Tom Riley, Douglas County public defender, represent Patrick Russell, the appellant in this case. As you know, Mr. Russell was resentenced pursuant to Miller, Mantich, Castaneda, and Montgomery. He was resentenced to a term of 110 to 126 years on the sole count of murder in the first degree. Our argument here is twofold. One, that sentence of 110 to 126 years is a de facto life sentence, and two, that the trial court erred in imposing a de facto life sentence absent a finding of irreparable corruption as required by Montgomery in violation of his Eighth Amendment rights against cruel and unusual punishment.
Obviously, why wouldn't State v. Garza from this court control this case?
Your Honor, we would argue that this case is distinguishable. 110 years on the bottom is the highest number that has been before this court in this appeal. Mr. Russell will not be eligible for parole until he is age 72, which we would argue is not even geriatric release, but is in fact beyond his life expectancy. I know that in State v. Smith, this court cited evidence by the state from the CDC that the average life expectancy is 78.8 years. However, that's not for an inmate. Also, that is both for men and women. According to the CDC, the average life expectancy for a male is closer to 76 years. However, the United States Sentencing Commission has found the average life expectancy for somebody serving a life sentence is actually 64 years. And there have been a couple cases around the country in Wyoming that have adopted those standards and, in fact, say that for a juvenile serving a life sentence, they expect that the life expectancy would actually be below age 64. And as Mr. Russell will not even be eligible until age 72 and will not be mandatorily discharged until age 80, that is far beyond his life expectancy.
How reliable are those statistics? If we're supposed to use statistics about life expectancy, should we break it down even further into whether you're white or whether you're black or whether you're...
In reviewing the CDC data, those statistics, depending on race, in my experience, do not differ that greatly. I believe that the difference between age 64 being the average life expectancy and age 72, that's enough years where we don't have to get that specific based on that, Your Honor. The United States Sentencing Commission found that an average life sentence is 39 years, and the average age of an inmate entering prison was 25, and so that leads to the age 64 life expectancy. I believe that the test for a de facto life sentence is whether or not the sentence provides a meaningful opportunity for release based on demonstrated rehabilitation and maturity. Obviously, in these resentencing cases, we are in a unique position to be able to review decades of records. So in most cases, a sentencing judge will have to have foresight and think about what might happen in the future, how this juvenile might mature, doesn't have, obviously, the records that we that this sentencing judge had before him. Mr. Russell demonstrated rehabilitation. He is age 62 now. He had some trouble through his early years. Our expert, Dr. Neuring, explained these troubles he had early in his years by explaining how neglected he was at home. He said he had to learn how to take care of himself, and this did not happen until his 20s or 30s. So those years in prison were beneficial for him, where he got his high school diploma. He had consistent work. He now holds the position of a lead porter, which is the highest position an inmate can have. So the sentencing judge had all of this before him. which, and just to get back to the de facto life sentence, since this court has addressed the other cases here, states around the country have found that, at least 9 states have found that sentences which allowed a defendant to be eligible between the ages of 61 and 70 years old all constituted de facto life sentences.
The U.S. Supreme Court has not adopted the sort of analysis that you're talking about, has it?
No, it has not, Your Honor.
There is no controlling authority which would require the implementation of a de facto life standard, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. There is a split among the states. As this court remembers, there was also a split about retroactivity, and that was ultimately decided by the Supreme Court. It's our position the Supreme Court will decide this issue, but states such as Connecticut, New Jersey, Florida, Illinois, Iowa, Ohio, Washington, and Wyoming have all adopted the standard that a de facto life sentence, there's no difference between the de facto life sentence where somebody's getting out between the ages of 61 and 70 years old, which is obviously younger than Mr. Russell, that constitutes a life sentence for purposes of satisfying the requirements of Miller and Montgomery.
But Miller did not categorically ban a life sentence without parole, right?
It did not, Your Honor. That leads to our second argument, that we believe the language in Montgomery greatly expanded Miller's holding and says that Miller requires not only that you consider youth as a mitigating factor, but actually says that the Eighth Amendment is violated if a sentence of life without parole is given to a defendant whose crime reflects transient immaturity. And they use that specific language. They also say that the trial court must find that rehabilitation is impossible. And again, with the record before us, in Mr. Russell's case, the court did not find that, and it's our argument could not find that. And so therefore, imposed a de facto life sentence in violation of his Eighth Amendment rights.
What have the cases said about a meaningful life post-release?
Some other states have defined it as having a chance for fulfillment outside prison walls, reconciliation with society, a sentence that provides hope to reconnect with society. That was from Connecticut. In Iowa, they've decided that a defendant's potential for geriatric release is not enough to comply with Miller. This does not constitute a meaningful opportunity.
Those are the de facto states.
Yes, they are.
And there's contrary authority.
Yes, there is, Your Honor. And basically, with the standard being having demonstrated that rehabilitation, what we believe is that the bottom number should provide an opportunity for a defendant to go before the parole board and show what he or she has done in the decades that he or she has been in prison to show that they have matured and that they have rehabilitated. Because, and this is obviously due to all of the science that has been adopted by the U.S. Supreme Court and by this court, that shows that juveniles' brains are not fully developed.
So maybe you've already articulated this, but what should the bottom line number be? What should this court adopt under your analysis for the bottom line to be? What is the bottom line number of years?
Your Honor, we would argue maybe about after serving 30 years, the parole board should consider release. That obviously translates to a 60-year sentence. That number comes from the average life sentence being 39 years, so that allows 9 years if released immediately, which we know doesn't happen all the time. That would allow 9 years outside of prison. Also, that would leave most of our clients who were juveniles just about age 50, which all the science shows that at that age they've aged out of crime and they are much less likely to reoffend.
So the big picture is that you would seek a bottom number that would put Mr. Russell in front of the parole board sooner.
That is correct, Your Honor. He has served over 44 years so far, so an 88-year sentence. The next highest case that this court has seen is Castaneda, which was 105 to 125 years, but as the court articulated, that was 2 homicides and an attempted homicide along with 5 other counts, and the sentencing court did impose along the lower range, 40 to 50, on the homicides. So this case is different in that we are here for the sole count of homicides.
When you rely on statistics, what effect does or should changes in the statistics, either a reduction in life expectancy or an increase in life expectancy, have on the application of the constitutional standards that you're talking about? Are these constitutional standards simply going up and down depending on if they find a cure for cancer or if the environment negatively affects people? Is that what you're advocating for?
Your Honor, I believe that the parole board could adequately address that if, you know, if life expectancy drastically changes for some reason, the parole board could address that, and if somebody came before them at age 50 and they thought they had another 60 years to live because of, you know, changing medicine, then perhaps the parole board could address that and keep them in for a little bit longer.
So it is part, it is or is not part of the constitutional analysis?
The statistics for life expectancy?
Yes.
I would say it is, Your Honor, because what, all we have right now is the constitutional standard of meaningful opportunity for relief, and without looking at it on a case-by-case basis and looking at family history, all we can really rely on is statistics.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Vincent, good morning to you.
May it please the Court, my name is Melissa Vincent. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the Appalachian State of Nebraska. Russell claims he received a de facto life sentence. The District Court was required to find that he was irreparably corrupt before imposing it. However, I note those claims are identical to the claims that were raised by the defendant, rejected by this Court in State v. Garza. Because Russell is sentenced to a term of years that renders him eligible for parole, the only issue for this Court is whether his sentence was excessive. We submit that it was not. While I believe several factors support the District Court's decision in this case, I want to focus more narrowly on the evidence suggesting that Russell has matured or been rehabilitated. The various factors cited by Russell in his brief do deserve special attention. His conduct and his work history, while it is true that both have been very good, they have not improved over time. Indeed, they have remained consistent throughout his incarceration, which I would submit to you shows only that he does very well in a structured environment. You really want to assess the progress that he's made in terms of growth and maturity. You have to subtract those two things from the analysis and look at what you're left with, which frankly isn't much. He got his GED in 1981 and a welding certificate in 1988, completed a handful of Bible study courses throughout the early 90s, done nothing in the last 25 years to better himself. He has, however, filed a whole host of lawsuits against various individual entities, which, as the probation officer suggested, seems to be an outward manifestation of that unresolved anger that he has been repeatedly urged to address but has thus far refused. And that's one of the things that differentiates Russell from the other defendants who have been sentenced pursuant to slur. He has legitimate mental health issues that A, appear to have a genetic component, and B, have never been properly addressed because he has proven completely and utterly resistant to treatment. Part of it, and he has made that abundantly clear throughout his incarceration. Now, arguably, one of the only things he had going for him was his acceptance of responsibility, but he's regressed on that measure. He went from admitting he committed the crime to saying he doesn't want to talk about it, now flatly denying that he did it and saying that he wasn't even there. And that regression appears to be symptomatic of a larger problem, namely that Russell lacks any genuine sense of guilt or shame, empathy or remorse, his anger, bitterness, and resentment. And I think that backs away heavily in the District Court's sentencing decision, because if you look at the Court's comments, which go on for several pages, there's really nothing positive in there. It's mostly just a laundry list of negatives, followed by the Court's stated intention to impose a sentence that will not depreciate the seriousness of the offense and will, quote-unquote, protect society, which, of course, suggests the Court believes that Russell continues to pose a threat. I agree.
Is there evidence of risk to reoffend in the record?
The LSTMI that was conducted by the probation officer, I believe the score was 32.
And what does that evidence show?
What's that?
What does that evidence show?
Well, it put him in the very high-risk category to reoffend.
Didn't Dr. Nuring say that wasn't an appropriate test for somebody who's been convicted of murder?
Sure, he did. But, you know, again, I think that's something for the District Court to consider and project if it wants to. I mean, of course, the LSTMI standard is used routinely in regular sentencing cases. That's the best position. That's what those factors mean, and descriptions. I mean, I guess I should digress for just a moment to the probation officer in this case. She did a phenomenal job. But there's a very thorough analysis under each one of those factors, or even disregard the total score. As I was saying, I agree with the court's ultimate determination. I see nothing in this record that suggests that Russell's crime was the product of the kind of adolescent limited behavior that inspired the U.S. Supreme Court's decisions in Graham and Miller. I believe his problems go deeper than that, and again, have never really been addressed. And for that reason, I think the district court could have resentenced Russell to life without parole, without running afoul of the Eighth Amendment. And that being said, I see no problem with the sentence imposed in this case. There was no abuse of discretion, unless the court has questions.
So is it your position that even though the district court judge didn't use the magic words of irreparable corruption, the findings made by the court would suggest that?
Yeah, it's my position that Montgomery does not establish a requirement. In fact, they specifically say, look, we didn't have that requirement on the states, but not free, you know, to sentence them to life without parole. Factors, but there's been nothing since Montgomery, so we have no statement from the Supreme Court saying this is required. So unless this court imposes that requirement, no, it's not. I think the record just needs to support it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. Our next case...